Maybe I'll just begin by introducing myself. I'm Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and many of you have met or at least seen my wife, Sarah, who's been doing twice the work that she normally should have to do in order for me to be able to be gone for about 2.5, actually almost 3 weeks. And I visited 3 countries, Mexico, El Salvador, Nicaragua. I got back midnight, Tuesday night, have been averaging about 4 hours of sleep for the last 4 or 5 nights. And to be honest, it would be interesting to see how this goes, because emotionally I feel like a kind of a dry sponge. There's a certain amount of culture shock in re-entry, and I know on the bus coming up here a lot of people were talking, and I was just kind of sitting by myself looking out the window. And so if I'm not, if I'm more rambling than normal, which I would think I am, that probably helps explain it. Just also for background for people who don't know this, is that my wife Sarah and I lived for Central America for about 2 years. We were living in the country of Nicaragua and traveled throughout other countries in the region. Returned about a year ago. And since having returned to the States, we've been traveling back there periodically. I was there in December, and again more recently in the last couple of weeks. With the title focused on El Salvador, I thought that I would focus most attention on El Salvador, and that doesn't mean we can't talk about Nicaragua or Mexico, and there'll be time when you can raise questions, and I'll be making some analogies between the countries as we go. But I wanted to start out with just having you help me by lifting up some of the images that you have, particularly of El Salvador. What are some of the images that come to you through your experience or through the news or through whatever form? What are the images you have of El Salvador?
Repressive, military.
So she's saying repressive, military. How about others?
Refugees.
Refugees.
Fear.
Democracy. That's what the Reagan administration called it.
Okay, democracy.
The Savior.
El Salvador translates as the Savior. Others. Yeah, if we can. Maybe some people would be willing to sit on the floor. We'll open up some chairs. Basically, we're beginning by just lifting up some images that people have of El Salvador.
Innocent people dying.
Okay, innocent people dying. Let me ask. Oh, go ahead.
The Lutheran Church.
Okay, the Lutheran Church. El Salvador is probably the only Central American country that has an active Lutheran church. And as that's many of our background, I'll touch on that a little bit as well.
New bishop.
New bishop.
And an assassinated pastor recently.
How many of you know nothing about El Salvador? Okay, everybody feels like they know a little bit. Okay. With that in mind, what I thought I would do is just touch on a number of recent images from the trip that I was just on, and then offer not a major presentation by any means, but just a few thoughts to think about in terms of some analysis of what's going on in El Salvador, at least from my perspective. Some of the images I have, you were talking, one of the images that people brought up was refugees. El Salvador is a country that has approximately 1 million people living outside of its borders who have fled in the last 6 years or so. Keep in mind that there's probably a total population of El Salvador of a little over 5 million now. So approximately a fifth, maybe a little less than a fifth of the people have fled the country in the last 6 years. There's also more than 500,000 internal refugees in El Salvador. And one of my images in being in El Salvador was the situation of the refugees. I visited one of the refugee camps It's a refugee camp that is run by a number of different organizations and receives some of its help from the churches. About 1,600 people live at this refugee camp. And I have the image in my mind of a beautiful and huge citrus field that goes for miles or acres and acres and acres and acres, and you ask the people, who owns that land? And it's a colonel in the Salvador military. And then you see 1,600 people in this refugee camp living in conditions that most of us can't even imagine. Living in, you can't even call them shacks. It's almost like extended warehouses with divisions where 10, 12, 14, 16 people live. I was told that one of the U.S. people who's working in El Salvador rescued the final baby kitten and brought it into El Salvador because all of the cats and dogs had recently been eaten at the camp as the people struggled to survive. You talk to the people about why they've come there, and all of them had stories of recent bombings or over the bombings over the last year and a half or 2 years. If you know very much about El Salvador, it's a U.S.-backed government. It's a government that the United States gives about $1.5 million dollars a day to in aid. And the U.S. government says that most of that aid is economic. One of the things you learn in El Salvador is that there is very little distinction between economic and military aid. It is all going for the purpose of a war. And a war that is very much being fought against civilians, psychologically, militarily. So in the case of this camp, most of the people who had left had been in areas of pretty sophisticated and saturated bombing of civilians in an effort to displace the rural population, which is seen as the base of support for a group you've probably heard of called the FMLN, which is a group of rebels, guerrillas, whatever, an armed group of people who have been fighting against the Salvadoran government. So one of my images is that refugee camp. A kitten that survived, a colonel with thousands of acres of land, and the people without hardly any. Another one of my images was visiting a cooperative way up on the Guatemalan border. It's a cooperative I had not been before. You hear in the States a lot about, at least from the State Department and from the U.S. Embassy, and we had an embassy visit, about the reforms that have taken place in El Salvador, about the United States pushing towards democracy in El Salvador, the U.S. encouraging the Salvadoran military to cut down on its abuses against civilians, an improved human rights situation. Well, my image from visiting this cooperative is that the land reform in El Salvador is a very curious land reform. It's a land reform that doesn't give secure titles of land to its people. It's a land reform that basically allowed, for the most part, the largest landowners in the country to sell off some of their worst land at highly inflated prices. That the campesinos, who were lucky enough to get land, and most campesino just simply translates as people of the land. Most of the people don't have any land, so if they were lucky enough to get a piece of land, what they inherited was an enormous debt because of the inflated prices that the large landowners were able to charge when they sold off their worst lands to the government in the land reform. And so we met with campesinos, glad to have gotten land, but very much in danger of having that land taken away. And in fact, I heard a figure that somewhere around 90 or 95% of the government-sponsored cooperatives that were formed in El Salvador have or are about to go out of business because of a land reform. And I'll talk about this later, because of the way the land reform is structured. Now, just shifting gears a little bit, and again, I'll leave time for questions. It's very different than the Nicaraguan land reform. And keep in mind that the Nicaraguan government is the government that the U.S. says is communist, is terrorist, is a threat to its neighbors, is repressing its people, etc. The Nicaraguan land reform gives secure titles of land to people. They own the land. They can't sell the land, because the idea is you're trying to break the cycle of a small group of people being able to control the land. But they can pass the land on to their children and their grandchildren. They get the land without paying a cent for it. They don't inherit any debt. They have access to bank credit, which is, in El Salvador, a very severe problem for most of the campesinos, the majority of people. Another image I have is an image of meeting with the director of the Independent Human Rights Commission in El Salvador. And he was talking about how, again, the United States portrays El Salvador as an emerging democracy, cites the efforts that we've made to control human rights abuses, and you've got statistics to verify it, statistics that most of the human rights organizations would agree on, that the number of bodies showing up in the streets in El Salvador is down from what it was in 1981 and 1982, when hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bodies could be found all throughout El Salvador, almost on a daily basis. So it's true, the numbers are down. And yet, according to the president of this Human Rights Commission, the human rights situation is as bad as it was before, and it's worsening. And what he said is that as the popular movements grow, as labor unions start to organize again, as students start to be more visible in their protests, as teachers start to be more vocal in their protests, as the economic crisis worsens and people start making more demands on the government, that what you see emerging, or what we saw happen in El Salvador in 1980, 1981, and 1982, was massive repression against the people. And his description was that they literally cut off the head of all of these movements through massive assassinations. He said, repression in El Salvador can be read like a barometer. As the popular movement grows, the repression grows. So all throughout El Salvador, I have in my mind an image of every demonstration the government is videotaping and cataloging who's at the demonstrations, who the people are. The Lutheran church that someone mentioned was recently broken into by armed gunmen and taken over. What was stolen? The list of donors to the Lutheran church, names being taken, written down. I don't know how many of you know that there was an earthquake in El Salvador, October 10th. In light of the earthquake in San Salvador, which destroyed a lot of the poor people's housing, which was most vulnerable to earthquake, people felt like they could no longer not organize, that despite the fears that they had and despite the memory of the incredible repression that had taken place in 80 and 81 and 82, they began to organize because they had to, and they know that their names are going on a list. So my image as I was listening to this human rights worker in El Salvador was that I was speaking to a dead man, was that it was only a matter of time. He had already been arrested in the last and put in jail for 6 months, three other workers at the Human Rights Commission. Some of you may know that there's another group in El Salvador, a group called the Mothers of the Disappeared. It's an organization primarily of mothers, as its name implies, that was formed with the help of Archbishop Romero, a progressive bishop who sided with the people and was assassinated shortly after appealing to then-President Carter to stop all military aid to his country because it was being used to repress the people. Within the last month, the Mothers of the Disappeared offices were blown up, four people injured. So the intimidation is growing, the mass movement is growing, and the corresponding repression begins to build. Again, you can contrast that with the situation in Nicaragua. There are some human rights problems in Nicaragua. And certainly the war takes a toll and creates an environment. But it's nothing on the order of what you see from the U.S. allied government in El Salvador. Another image I have is an image of the U.S. Embassy. U.S. Embassy has a cement wall built around it. Huge. They call it the $1 million wall. They just built one around the embassy in Nicaragua. Same thing, Sarah. Despite the fact that there has never once been an attack on the embassy in Nicaragua. In fact, the U.S. ambassador, former U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua, said that Nicaragua was the only country in the world he knew where he could walk anywhere in the country without protection. They built another $1 million wall. The sense of a fortress mentality that is understandable on the one hand, because you can understand the fear of terrorist attacks, but is very reflective of the kind of lack of support, lack of rootedness with the people, a militaristic posture of defending basically unjust privileges. So that's one of my images. And listening to U.S. Embassy personnel tell in a very, very clear way, talk about the improvements in El Salvador and the life and the changes, and then you start asking them specific questions. And to every specific question we ask, whether it be about the land reform or whether it be about whether Duarte had any power, Duarte is the president, or who ran the country, oh, I'm sorry, we're not an expert on that. We simply don't know about that. And then one last image before talking about a couple of specific issues is the issue is the image of worshiping on a Sunday morning at a Catholic church in a relatively poor barrio in San Salvador. And they were celebrating, what was it, the 10th, I believe, 8th or 10th anniversary of the assassination of their priest. And it was the assassination of this priest that was one of the turning points in the life of Archbishop Romero. Archbishop Romero was selected as Archbishop in El Salvador because he was known to be very conservative, and he was figured by the Catholic hierarchy and others that he would not get himself involved in any of the political issues in El Salvador. And what happened to him is he was converted by the poor. He was converted by the violence. He was converted by the repression against his own priests. And so they had a picture of this priest who had died, I can't remember, 8 or 10 years ago, and they were celebrating, and on the wall they had a list, must have been of 25 or 30 assassinated priests, nuns, archbishops, etc. in El Salvador. Now that in itself was striking enough, but what's really striking to me is the sermon that this priest gave. Sometime maybe I took good notes on this sermon. Sometime I may read the sermon, but I'll just tell you that the sermon was a powerful, powerful sermon based on trying to understand the significance of the Eucharist. And essentially one of the things that he said was that just as God fed the people with manna in the wilderness, that the people of El Salvador are walking through a wilderness, and they are being fed by the examples of the martyrs of the people who lived out their faith until death as a sign and a feeding of the people to take courage and be faithful to the cause of Jesus. Powerful, powerful sermon right before the martyrs and in a time of growing repression in El Salvador. And for me, that's a powerful example that I can't tell each of us or each of you what you should do in response to El Salvador or Nicaragua. But what I can tell you is that from my perspective, these are not normal times, they're extraordinary times. They call us to examine our own lives with others to try to deepen our commitments. Okay, a few kind of analytical observations that I would encourage you to think about. One of the most tragic elements of the situation in El Salvador for me is that what I see the United States government doing throughout Central America is using elections as a substitute for democracy. In general, U.S. people love elections. And it's one of the tragedies of El Salvador, because El Salvador had an election, and because a Christian Democrat candidate won, we wash our hands of the issue. El Salvador disappears from the news. There's no thoughtful or very little thoughtful or critical analysis. And a tragedy, an unbelievable tragedy, is carried out precisely because the U.S. government was smart enough to understand that we would fall for it. The use of elections as a substitute for democracy. What do I mean? A Christian Democrat won the elections in El Salvador, but a Christian Democrat is not in power in El Salvador. The U.S. Embassy is in power in El Salvador. The El Salvadoran military is next in power in El Salvador. The El Salvadoran oligarchy or economic elite is next in power in El Salvador. And then maybe you can talk about Duarte, who is the civilian elected president. It's very important to understand that throughout Central America, the U.S.-backed governments are being used as a smokescreen to cover up policies that most of us would find alarming, and that most decent U.S. people would be opposed to. But there's a mask in that mask. And maybe to tell a joke to you that's told by the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador, who himself has been in prison, has seen the death of one of his pastors. And in response to the question, who runs El Salvador, told the following jokes. He said, there's an airplane. And on the airplane, you have three powerful people. On the airplane, you have the Pope, you have President Reagan, and you have the civilian elected president of El Salvador, Duarte. And the pilot comes running out and says, I'm sorry, but we're going to crash. One engine's out, the other engine's going. We've only got one parachute. And you have to decide, gentlemen, who gets the parachute. President Reagan leaps to his feet and says, it's mine, I'm the leader of the free world. Democracy in the world can't possibly survive without me. And the Pope shoves him down and says, no, it's mine. I'm the leader of 600 million Catholics throughout the world. How can the flock survive without me? Duarte sits there rather calmly and says, gentlemen, let's survive. Let's resolve this in a democratic way. Let's have elections. And so the votes come in, and Reagan gets one vote, and the Pope gets one vote, and Duarte gets 20 votes. And President Reagan gets the parachute. That's who runs El Salvador. Okay, this second joke he tells is much shorter. He says, and this is a joke you hear in the Philippines and in a lot of other places, why is the United States the only country in the world that hasn't had a military coup d'etat, meaning a military takeover of power from a civilian government? Why is the U.S. the only country in the world that hasn't had a coup d'etat? Because it's the only country in the world without a U.S. embassy. That's who runs El Salvador. This is the Lutheran bishop. You know how Jesus spoke in parables, right? That's speaking in a fairly direct parable, but it shares an essential truth. Okay, a second observation. From the perspective of the U.S. government, economic reforms are a form of counterinsurgency warfare. In other words, there has been a little bit of a land reform in El Salvador. Why? Not because you want to distribute land and power to campesinos, because you want to try to hold off social change. There were civilian elections. Okay, you elected a civilian government. Of course, a lot of candidates weren't able to run, but you at least elected, you had that. Does that mean you're really interested in democracy? No, it's cosmetic. It's part of a counterinsurgency warfare. It's very dangerous to use economic reforms as counterinsurgency. And again, I would contrast that with our experiences in Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, it's one of the only countries in the world that I see where power is being redistributed in the form of land to campesinos who have clear titles to it and work it, in the form of nationalization of banks so that credit can be go out to places it's never been before. There are structural reforms happening in the nature of society that give the poor a basis of political power and a basis of support. The reforms, in quotes, that you see in places like El Salvador and other places where U.S. counterinsurgency campaigns are operating are meant as pacification programs against the people that do not redistribute power. So you see, in terms of the refugee question again in El Salvador, you see that the government is now that it's bombed the people, has relocated them more or less in concentration camp type conditions, now it's carrying out government-sponsored repopulation efforts, trying to get people out. And who's handing out the rice and beans but the Salvadoran military, all paid for by USAID dollars. They're not giving land. They're not distributing power. They even had a little bit of a literacy crusade in El Salvador, or a literacy program. What do? They basically have cut it off. Why? One critique was offered, we had to stop the literacy crusade because they were teaching people how to think. And that wasn't the purpose. Again, we have to look very, very carefully at what's happening beneath the appearances, beneath the surface. Third observation, I kind of alluded to this already, is that under the U.S. management in El Salvador, we are seeing the management of terror. That indiscriminate terrorism against the people that you saw in 1980, 81, 82 served a purpose. The purpose was to cut off the heads of the popular organizations, but also to sow a seed of fear so that people will have in their minds past terror. And what that allows you to do is you can cut down on the numbers of bodies in the streets. You just selectively target your people. Enough dead bodies so that people remember the past. Enough people put in jail and tortured from the popular organizations, from the churches, from the human rights groups, that you sow that fear, that you keep that collective memory alive. But that should not be confused for concern about human rights, particularly if you define human rights not only in terms of physical abuse, but also the right of people to have some say in their economic livelihood. Again, just to hop over to Nicaragua, you've heard a lot about the U.S.-backed Contras. What are they doing in Nicaragua? They're sowing terror. Terrorism is being managed there also. And what do? They put mines and roads and civilian vehicles run over them to sow terror. They target the major successes of the revolution, which have been health care, land reform, and education. So who do the Contras go after? They go after the farm cooperatives. They go after the agrarian reform workers. They go after the health centers. In a little community near where I was, the Contras had burned 7 or 8 health centers in the last month. They'd attacked cooperatives throughout the region, etc. And by the way, if you haven't read, I would encourage you to try to get a hold of some of the testimony that went into Nicaragua's case against the United States before the World Court. Because one of the former Contra leaders who left because he couldn't stomach the terrorism testified at that hearing that when he criticized the FDN, which is the largest Contra group, and when he talked to CIA officials and U.S. government officials about the terrorism, he was told that terrorism was the way they had to conduct the war. In other words, this is not the act of Contras that are beyond U.S. control. These are the actions of people who are carrying out official U.S. governmental policy. And we have to come to terms with that, it seems to me. Another observation from El Salvador is that the poverty, the repression, the lack of democratic reforms is resulting, and the earthquake, which took place on October 10th, is resulting in a very, very strong growing of the popular movements, which to me is incredibly impressive because of the fears under which people are living. That a popular movement can grow in the conditions of El Salvador. And one of the things that the popular movement is demanding is they're demanding a negotiated settlement to the war in El Salvador. Duarte was elected on a platform of bringing an end to the war by negotiating with the FMLN. The United States has not allowed him to negotiate, and the popular movement is growing, and that's a reason for hope. It's also a reason why, from my perspective, each of us in this room needs to start making the issue of El Salvador much more visible in terms of the U.S. Congress and the U.S. people. Another observation, very quick one, is the incredible faith of the people. Both within the base Christian communities on the Catholic side, the Lutheran Church, the base Christian communities at the base level in Nicaragua, tremendous examples of faith. People ask me, why do you go back to Central America? Jeez, you lived there for a couple years, and one of the reasons I go is to have my heart pricked again, to recapture my sense of urgency, to refuel the ideas that Sarah and I have about the changes we need to continue making in our lives and how we can continue deepening our commitments. But another reason is to be filled with the hope of the people there. Sounds like such a contradiction, doesn't it? I mean, I've been describing horrendous things, and yet the hope of the people of faith and their determination is incredible. It should be an example, I think, to each of us. The analogy was made in advertising this tonight about Vietnam. Hey, let me just make two quick observations about that. One is that the people of Central America don't talk about what's happening in Central America as another Vietnam. They talk about it as another Central America, as another U.S. example of the U.S. operating. They have had a long history of U.S. interventions. They've seen the U.S. before. The Nicaraguans have seen before the destabilization of democratic reform governments in Chile, Guatemala. They don't have to look to Vietnam. They look to their own history. And that's something that we need to do with them, it seems to me, is reevaluate our own history. Another observation is that, and I would encourage any of you who are familiar with the magazine, The Other Side magazine, they recently accepted an article I sent to them, a rather lengthy one, about 15 pages on low-intensity conflict, which is basically the fancy Pentagon term for the type of warfare that the U.S. is fighting. And just to say, you can look at that if you want to know more details about what all is entailed with that. But one of the things is it learns a lot of lessons from Vietnam, including the fact that you don't want to introduce U.S. troops. You want other people to do the dying, because if you introduce U.S. troops, the American people, the U.S. people will start getting organized. If you have a draft, parents and students will get mobilized in the United States. If you utilize your National Guard and your National Reserves and foreign armies, they probably won't. So the war is being fought in Central America specifically to learn lessons from Vietnam so that it will not be another Vietnam. And yet, in my view, the likelihood of the introduction of U.S. troops increases every day as the policy, overall policy, unravels. So it's not something that we should be unconcerned about. Okay, I'm almost done here. Domestic implications for me. Someone pointed out, I guess it was you, okay, that El Salvador translated is the savior. I put a copy of a book I wrote during our time in Nicaragua. It's called The Politics of Compassion. It's in the bookstore. And it deals a lot with these issues, and it deals a lot with El Salvador as well, and Nicaragua. And one of the things I said in that book is that I believe that there's something more than just fate that the little tiny countries of Nicaragua and El Salvador should be kind of at the center of world history right now. And the fact that El Salvador translates as the savior makes me think about a number of things, including and especially that I believe that what is happening in El Salvador must be understood by us, or we are condemning ourselves. In other words, what's at stake for me in El Salvador, U.S. policy in El Salvador, is not just the suffering of the Salvadoran people. That's very important. It's the most important thing for me. But also for me, it's the erosion of our own democratic principles. And it's the very likelihood of eventually major repression against U.S. people. For me, it is ludicrous to believe that our government can export repression, train death squads, call the Contras freedom fighters, without expecting for that repression to come home to roost. And I would just call your attention to the fact that there's a Christic Institute suit, I'm not going to go into much detail on that, it's another conversation sometime, that is basically one of the things they uncovered. That's a Jesuit public law firm in the United States. So one of the things they uncovered is that President Reagan signed a secret directive a couple of years ago that resulted in the construction of 10 concentration camps in the United States, adjacent to or on U.S. military bases, with the capacity to house at least 400,000. Presumably, the scenario that they laid out was to house 400,000 Central Americans that would be rounded up after the U.S. invades Central America. The other thing that was happening under this directive was the training of paramilitary groups within the United States. This began in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Florida, that would basically, these troops would be utilized in the case of demonstrations against the U.S. invasion in Central America, against any of us in this room who would be out protesting that war. I just give that as one example of the kind of dangers that I'm talking about. Now, last thing. The tragedy of El Salvador is a bipartisan tragedy. Any progressive Democrats in the room who are feeling like, well, this isn't the problem of my party. Both Republicans and Democrats love Napoleon Duarte in El Salvador. It's a bipartisan tragedy. And in the case of Nicaragua, there's more conflict. And yet, in general, the focus of the debate is the Sandinistas are evil, we got to get rid of them, the question is how. It's a very dangerous debate. The issues I'm posing then go beyond Republican and Democrat. But they do call each of us, it seems to me, to be more involved in the political process. And there's going to be numbers of options to do that. This fall, another $105 million for the Contra will be voted on. Continuously, there is more aid being asked for El Salvador. All kinds of questions will be coming up related to that. The churches that I mentioned are such a good example in both Nicaragua and El Salvador, particularly at the base, are now in El Salvador trying to repopulate refugees outside of government control. And they desperately need money. They desperately need people who are willing to accompany the people in that process. And they're in the back of that the book that I mentioned, there are addresses of various groups who are working in both El Salvador and Nicaragua if you want to get some addresses. I did, by the way, also put out some brochures from the Center for Global Education, which is the program that Sarah continues to work with, the program that we were working with when we were living with in Nicaragua, and I was leading a trip through the Center for Global Education of Augsburg College. If people are interested in possibly traveling, or you know people who might be interested in traveling to Central America, one vehicle for doing so is the Center for Global Education, and there are some resources out there. So let's open it up now for discussion, and I assume that some people might be furious at what I've said. Let's just get some things out, or other questions that people might have, either about El Salvador or Nicaragua at this point. Yes?
Custom comments based on Nicaraguans, I know the refugees from Nicaragua and also from my time in Nicaragua. I'm not a fan of either El Salvador government or the one in Managua. And really just three comments. You mentioned the problems in El Salvador with land reform. The Sandinistas did not have this problem because they basically expropriated the land. From both the large landowners and the small landowners. Second thing is that they take names in El Salvador. As you know, they take names in that block committee or whatever in Managua. So, you know, I'm I'm not defending or condemning either. I think we're being a little balanced. Then to the smokescreen of the U.S. government supporting democracy, one doesn't have to look very far to San Jose, Costa Rica, which is a vibrant democracy, is supported by the United States, and has been both those things for decades.
Okay, just a couple quick comments about each of those. The problem of land reform. In Nicaragua, most of the land that the government has that it's used in the land reform was land that it inherited from Somoza when Somoza and his close allies left the country in 1979, and they received about 20% of the agricultural land in the country. Interestingly enough, the government has reduced its sector to probably about 13 or 14% now. So most of the land has come from there. There are expropriation terms under which the government can expropriate land in Nicaragua, and those terms are basically that there are no restrictions on the amount of land you can own in Nicaragua as long as you use your land productively. If you decapitalize your land, some examples of decapitalization would be if you took all your machinery over to Costa Rica and sold it off, it's clear you're not interested in production, then you can have your land expropriated. If you allow your cotton or your, say, coffee trees to get run down. Coffee trees, if you let them run down for 3 or 4 years, won't produce very much anymore. Your land can be expropriated. There's been almost no, in fact, I would say basically no expropriation of land from small landholders in Nicaragua. And there's been relatively few expropriations from large landowners in Nicaragua. Now, let me, in defense of the Salvadoran situation, let me say
that land is also paid for.
And that, and the land, other than in situations.
I comment on that before we get to something.
Yeah.
It is paid for. So under international law, it's nationalization, not expropriation, which is illegal under international law. But I know an engineer whose family owned a small dairy outside of Managua that was expropriated, and they were paid in 20-year bonds in local currency with no interest. So in fact, they were given the opportunity to leave Nicaragua and given basically worthless paper so to justify itself under the world court.
Yeah. Well, clearly there are different kinds of expropriation in Nicaragua, but if you talk to most international workers in Nicaragua, and my experience is that there have been very few expropriations of land for reasons other than legitimate decapitalization in Nicaragua. It's very, very rare to have that not be true. You can obviously find, and certainly you'll find a lot of wealthy Nicaraguans who have left Nicaragua for a variety of reasons, but there are a lot of other voices as well. In terms of the Sandinista defense committees or the Managua block committees spying on their neighbors, again, you hear charges of that in the States. You hear very few charges of that living in Nicaragua. The block committees take care of all kinds of things. They vaccinate children. They help make demands on the government in terms of services. They're involved in local defense, particularly outside of Managua, but also within Managua in terms of against Contra attacks. But while that's a common charge, I don't think that that's a common situation, certainly not based on our experience and based on the experience of lots of people that we worked with in Nicaragua, although again it is a very common charge in the United States. And in terms of elections in Costa Rica is has a very different history than the other countries of Central America. It's a country where that was blessed by the fact that it didn't have gold, and so the conquest stopped before they got to Costa Rica, and the land ownership patterns are somewhat different there. But my comment about Costa Rica would be two things. One, I'm very concerned about what's happening to Costa Rica as a result of overall U.S. policy in the region, that the Green Berets have been there. Costa Rica abolished its army when, in 1948, 1949, something like that. The Green Beret is now training. They don't call it the military, they call it the police in Costa Rica. Costa Rica is basically being pushed into a position based largely because of its debt, of being losing some of its independence. And also the Reagan administration is following a similar economic logic as it has in the United States. is forcing the Costa Ricans, as in order to receive aid, of divesting many of its industries in energy and other things. The state is divesting itself out of, which most people say will be an economic disaster for Costa Rica. So that a lot of the reforms and the kind of economic structure that redistributed wealth in Costa Rica and more or less allowed for fairly high standard of living. Costa Rica has almost a life expectancy equal to the United States, as does Cuba. It's dismantling that system, creating a lot of social turmoil. So if we're concerned about Costa Rican democracy is a fact, but I don't know how long it's going to be a fact in light of the present U.S. policies in the region.
But nonetheless, the U.S. has somehow fumbled into supporting democracy.
Yeah. See, I think the United States, the question is, and this is the question, I'll say this, this is a very radical statement. Living in Central America makes me wonder about how real our own democracy is. And what I mean by that is, I'm not questioning that we do have a democracy, and we do have elections, and we're free to participate and vote for whoever we want. But I have very serious doubts when the crunch comes whether that democracy will last. In other words, is the United States' commitment to democracy in Costa Rica, is that a commitment based on a real commitment to democracy in Costa Rica, or is it that things run there in a way that we feel reasonably okay about, and when the crunch comes, democracy will go by the wayside? That's a question I have within our own society as well. Other comments or questions? Your observation. Yeah.
You talked about a growing popular movement in El Salvador. Is that really possible given the terrorism and the fact that you talked about the movements have been, the heads cut off of various movements in the past? I mean, is it really possible for a popular movement to grow?
It remains to be seen whether the popular movements will be allowed to grow. It presents, again, the United States with a very precarious situation in El Salvador because, again, there was tremendous repression against those popular movements, and they didn't die, but they certainly went underground and more or less had to be very quiet. That allowed for somewhat more of an opening where you didn't have, again, as many bodies on the streets. You didn't have the overt forms of repression. Now those movements are beginning to build again. So the question is, what does that mean? On the one hand, the United States wants to continue with the image of a democracy in El Salvador. On the other hand, by having even the minimal opening that there is in El Salvador now, those movements are growing. And the question is, will they be allowed to grow? My guess on that is that they won't be allowed to grow, based on the people that I just met with in the last week and a half, that they'll be controlled at whatever cost. And if that means, in other words, if a more massive repression is necessary, it will happen. And there are all kinds of ways of creating a justification for that. One is just the existence of the FMLN itself. I mean, what happens is all the popular organizations in El Salvador are labeled as fronts for the FMLN.
And some of them are.
There are some that are, but to label all of them is pretty absurd. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't. At this point, the U.S. is in a very precarious position. What do you do when popular movements are building and you've been trying to repress them? You've been trying to control them. You've been trying to take a hold of events. And if you utilize mass repression, then the facade comes crumbling down. So it's a very tense situation. So I expect the selective repression to continue building, and whether that breaks into a full-scale repression. One of the things that everybody has agreed on in El Salvador is that the war will not be won by either side. I mean, it can go on and on and on and on and on. And that's why it's so important to in fact have a dialogue. But I would repeat, the country that's blocking the dialogue is the United States of America.
One of the things that happened in the Philippines was, as I understand it, this Corazon Aquino is a moderate, or she represents a moderate position, or is able to pull together a coalition of people and speak for more folks than, is there a moderate group in, say, Nicaragua that we could support that is a viable alternative to either the Sandinistas or the Contras? Or, I mean, are we ignoring and not seeing?
A couple of observations. First of all, an observation about the Philippines. Because I suspect we're going to see the Philippines explode. Mm-hmm. And the reason we're going to see the Philippines explode is because while it is true that Aquino was a uniting voice and the people against the dictatorship of Marcos, Aquino was of either the or one of the largest landowning families in the country. Basically, she's made decisions and placed into positions of power people from, largely from the economic elite in the Philippines. And it can't go on. The conditions that give rise to the social turmoil are so ripe and open in the Philippines that I think it's only a matter of time before that explodes. So I don't think that that's going to be, in the long term, a very viable example, unless there is, unless she deepens her ties with people's movements who are demanding more of a restructuring of the Filipino economy. Otherwise, and the other thing, just one other sidelight, I don't know, again, I won't try to go into much detail on the Christic Institute suit, but basically one of the things that emerges out of that suit is that Secord and Singlob and Owen and North and a couple of high-level CIA agents named Kleins and Shackley have more or less been running U.S. foreign policy for the past 27 years. And that the same people who have funded the Contras, carried out the selling of arms to Iran, also carried out the assassination of 100,000 people in Laos, the Phoenix program in Vietnam, which assassinated 60,000 civilians, were assassinating people with the Shah in Iran, were transferred back into the section that dealt with Latin America and destabilized the Allende government in 73. Same names, same people, funding their operations by running drugs and into the United States, which we're seeing that the Contras have been doing from an American U.S. person's ranch in Costa Rica, etc. The reason I bring that up is the place where these folks have been seen most recently is the Philippines. So a lot of people feel that the theater for this quote-unquote secret team, all the people who are going before the congressional hearings but none of the right questions being asked, right, are now operating in the Philippines. Okay, now back to Nicaragua. Is there a kind of a third force between the Sandinistas and the Contras that we could support? Well, in effect, that was the U.S. policy when it became clear that Somoza was going to be ousted. And it was too late. The U.S. hung on to Somoza for a long time. The idea was to try to work as effectively as the U.S. could to block the Sandinistas from any meaningful power. And one way that we did that is we funneled our economic aid through the private sector and to the most conservative Nicaraguan organizations, including COSEP, which is a large businessmen's association, that at the end was eager to get rid of Somoza, but basically wanted to continue more or less the same system, only without Somoza, so that they could have more of the profits that were going just to Somoza. So that was the third option that the United States chose. I would argue, and a lot of people might disagree with me, that the debate is the wrong debate. It's not that the Sandinistas are a perfect government, but the Sandinistas, from my point of view, have made a number of serious mistakes that we could talk about with people on the Atlantic coast. They've made some mistakes in terms of the economy. Maybe sometime in the next week or two, if there's room on the schedule, I'll try to do something on the Nicaraguan economy, because I believe that the Sandinistas are, in fact, a very moderate revolutionary force. And that if you're at all concerned about improving the lives of the majority of people who are poor, you have got to start talking about restructuring societies, not simply putting Band-Aids on them. And for example, within Nicaragua, not very many people know that in Nicaragua's elections in 1984, which the Sandinistas won with about 67% of the vote, that you have a Communist Party in Nicaragua. And the Communist Party got 1% of the vote. You have a Marxist-Leninist Party in Nicaragua. And the Marxist-Leninist Party got 1% of the vote. The Sandinistas are a very independent, nationalistic. They merged kind of three tendencies: nationalism, Christianity, and some elements of Marxism. And it's a very interesting, creative mix in the context of the country that they're a part of. So I think the U.S. mistake and the mistake of our mentality is to feel that rather than embracing and supporting movements that are going to try to restructure societies, but try to do it in a fairly humanistic way, we align ourselves with incredibly right-wing forces. Or, in the case of El Salvador, we try to distance ourselves some from the right-wing forces, deliberately try to elect a moderate, but we control the situation and allow the militaries to control the situation. So I feel like in the case of Nicaragua, that and in the case of other revolutions that are coming, if the United States can't live with the Sandinistas, we're not going to live with hardly any revolution, because it's a very moderate revolution. And if to the degree that it's making mistakes, some of those mistakes are based on assumptions that the Sandinistas carried with them. For example, they didn't understand the Atlantic coast, which is very different. It's indigenous peoples, and they made a lot of mistakes. But a lot of the mistakes that are made are the result of the kind of pressures that the United States is imposing through economic embargoes and through the war. Yeah?
I would just say on that question, too, that I think that we should let Nicaraguans solve their own problems, and that we shouldn't be worrying about backing, you know, some party to be in the moderate force. If Nicaraguans had elections and they elected the Sandinistas, that's the group of people they want in power. And if other people, and a lot of Nicaraguans told us this, who didn't like the Sandinistas and who didn't vote for them, for example, the Conservative Democratic Party, which is a more in-between type party. And they said, you know, just leave your contra money at home, and we're adults, we're capable citizens, we'll solve our own problems, and we'd like to, thank you, you know. And it made me realize that we are, in a way, so paternalistic. We want to help in one way or another, where Nicaraguans just feel like, bug out, you know, we'll do fine on our own if we're given the freedom and the openness to do so.
And that's a really good example, too, because this Conservative Democratic Party was really furious at the United States, because they have a long history in Nicaragua. They did come in second place in the elections. But the U.S., what the U.S. did was tried to bribe them to pull out of the elections so that the United States could say that the Nicaraguan elections weren't fair and free. And when they refused to accept the bribe, then the U.S. Embassy, the way it describes the Conservative Democratic Party, is they're just dupes of the Sandinistas. They're all Sandinistas, etc. So the U.S. just, not only are we intervening in the affairs in the kind of way Sarah says that we shouldn't be, but then it goes and does stuff like that. So it really discourages legitimate democratic opposition from building, because it doesn't fit our image of what that should be. I think there's a lot of interest in what's happening in the congressional hearings on the part of Nicaraguans. I also think that there's a deep awareness, historical awareness, and I share this, that it's unlikely that that money will be stopped. And if it is stopped, they'll find another channel. They saw the World Court as a major thing, and the U.S. just said, to hell with the World Court. And the last country to do that, by the way, was Iran during the U.S. hostage crisis. You know, they heard that the Boland Amendment was passed. And what happens when the Boland Amendment was supposed to stop the CIA and other government agencies from funding the Contras? What happens? They saw that the Contras were doing very well, thank you, in terms of money and guns and all that stuff. They know that that's happening. So yes, they look at it with interest, and yes, it gives them some measure of hope that maybe something will change. But I think they have a deeply historical understanding that the United States has dominated Central and Latin America, and unless the U.S. people truly demand some significant changes, that it's not going to change. So I think it's up to us to deepen those congressional hearings and deepen the implication of that, because the congressional hearings, this is my judgment, are basically being turned into a forum to build support for the Contra aid in the fall. I mean, they turn over hours and hours and hours of time to talk about the freedom fighters, and they don't have people from America's watch documenting what the Contras are doing. They don't have Witness for Peace people giving testimony about the latest clinic that's been blown up and Campesino that's been assassinated. And so they're, yes, they're very interested, but with a good reason. They're very, they're very standoffish about what it means. And it's up to us, I think, to really push that those hearings be more.